It's Monday morning, December 22nd, and time for all things political here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert, in this week for Kathleen Dunn. This hour, we're joined by Dennis Riley, professor of political science at the UW-Stevens Point. We'll be talking about the outgoing Bush administration, Senator Biden's remarks about his role in the new administration, and Barack Obama's proposed economic stimulus package, just to name a few. There's a lot there we could talk about. And I hope we'll be hearing from you this hour as well. The number to call with your questions and your comments is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. And Dennis Riley, so glad you could be with us today.
Good morning.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the outgoing message at the Bush White House. It seems as though he's going rather quietly into the good night. What do you think?
Well, he does seem to be, but the part of his problem is everywhere he goes to, as part of his farewell tour, there's sort of a bit of irony attached to it. Today, Walter Reed, well, but that was one of the big scandals late a couple of years ago, a year and a half or so. He went to Iraq, but that's a mixed blessing when he shows up in Iraq. And so I think he's got a problem going out big. He kind of has to go out low-key because his presidency didn't end as well as it began.
Well, do you think he's trying to put trying to make amends, I guess, for the feathers that he's ruffled during his two terms?
Well, I guess I wouldn't say that exactly, in that I don't think he sees himself as having anything to apologize for exactly, or even to make amends for. But in a way, I don't think he wants to be as divisive a lightning rod on his way out as he got to be over Iraq and the response to Katrina and so on. Like, he'd like to be just let out, you know, can I go now and I'm done. And as opposed to Vice President Cheney, who, you know, was pretty defiant in his sort of semi-exit interview with ABC News. I mean, he not only didn't apologize, he said when they get all the information we had, they're going to do the same things, which Joe Biden didn't think was true. Well, he had a few things to say about that yesterday morning.
Well, if I could ask you to psychologize for a moment, I don't think President Bush has said anything to this effect, but do you think that he goes out with regrets? I know it doesn't seem to be the case, but is that your take on it at all?
Well, it's really hard to say. I mean, he has always been kind of a hard guy for me to read, because if you read what comes out on the surface most of the time, and I think that's, I do read that first, of course, he really does seem to be pretty self-confident about just about anything he's ever tackled and just about anything he's ever been responsible for. Much more self-confident than I certainly would be about my 40-year teaching career. But on the other hand, I wonder if deep down he doesn't sometimes sit there and say, this didn't go so well.
Well, you do wonder, and he did give an interview on Fox News, this was last week, where he said, I didn't compromise my soul to be a popular guy. The impression there is that he's sort of saying, well, I stuck by my guns, I did what I believed was right, regardless of how popular I was with the public.
Right, and I think that that's a consistent theme for him, and it's a way that he and Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, while he was there, and a number of others, believed that real leadership is just deciding what needs to be done and then doing it, and don't even look at the polls, and if you look at the polls, don't worry about the polls, because they don't matter. What matters is your staunch leadership, and you're moving straight forward toward the targets you've identified. And in a democratic society, that is one way of defining leadership, but another way of defining leadership is to try to stick at least a little bit closer to the feelings of the people you represent.
Well, I know that time will tell how his presidency will be regarded ultimately. It's hard to get a totally clear read at this point because we're still very much in the midst of it. But do you think, as many others have printed, that he's going out with the knowledge that this may have been a failed presidency?
Well, you know, self-awareness isn't always one of the things that people associate with George Bush, or at least the willingness to reflect on the negative side of things. But he may still understand that you can't paint, you can try to paint Iraq as a success in his eyes, given what he wanted to accomplish. You can't paint the response to Katrina as a success. You can't paint Walter Reed as a success. You can't paint the economy coming apart at the seams as a success. I mean, in his eyes, I don't think the policies that some of us and some economists think may have contributed, mm-hmm. I don't think he sees those policies as having contributed, because he tends to see the world in terms of individual actors. And so there were some bad people that made some dumb decisions, but the basic system of deregulated economy and so on is healthy in his eyes. So I don't think he sees a lot of blame for it, but he's got to sit there and say, you know, this is going to be by name in the history books. And, you know, he made his famous remark that he'll be dead when they write the history books, so it probably won't matter. But I don't believe anybody can serve as president of the United States for 8 years and really believe that it doesn't matter what history says about you.
Right.
I just don't think you can get yourself to do that.
Well, he's certainly been more than amicable in terms of helping the transition to the Obama White House, which I guess is more than we can say for Dick Cheney, who's, as you said, been a bit defiant. What do you think is the different style there? I'm surprised they're not sort of presenting a united front on the message they're sending as they leave.
Yeah, well, I wonder if they sort of have parted company in many respects over the past year, maybe even the 2 years since Rumsfeld was fired. Cheney has less, he's been less and less visible, less and less talkative. I mean, when you get him to talk, he's defiant. But he's not been around as much, and he hasn't been as visible the last year and a half or so. And I suspect they may have had a parting of the ways about certain kinds of things, maybe about Iraq, maybe about other things, maybe about style. Maybe Bush just isn't as abrasive a person as he appeared to be during the middle part of his administration. Maybe he's deep down a little bit different kind of individual, and Cheney is an abrasive person. He was an abrasive person 30 years ago when he was chief of staff for Gerald Ford.
Well, and Cheney has been criticized recently in the press by VP-elect Joe Biden, who says that Cheney had overstepped his constitutional role. And I guess that's something that might be on the table for the future. And I think that Joe Biden had even intimated that they might be looking at whether or not there would be prosecution involved.
Yeah. And they might be, although I really would doubt that they want to open up that can of worms. I mean, I think if the president-elect and the vice president-elect really want to move forward and hold at least some semblance of a bipartisan administration, some semblance of cooperation, of bringing people together, the last thing in the world they want to do is put Dick Cheney on trial for something.
Mm-hmm.
Because that will then open wounds, it will bring out the right-wing blogosphere, it will just do things. And they know they're going to do that sometime. They're going to upset those people. But they'd probably rather do it over a national health care policy,
right,
or something else, something that has high stakes. If after 5 years you get to put Dick Cheney in jail for a year, what have you accomplished?
And I guess it wouldn't seem to fit with Obama's feel-good agenda at this point.
No, I don't think it would. And I think he probably believes that deep down that Cheney and Bush made horrendous mistakes, and those mistakes are borderline criminal perhaps, but not criminal enough to move forward with the criminal law prosecution. They're discredited. They're gone. Let's get on with things. And that feel-good agenda of his is going to take some work to get through, and it's going to take some political capital that he probably doesn't want to spend prosecuting a 67-year-old former vice president.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go ahead and take a phone call right now. We've got Stephen with us from Madison. Hi, Stephen.
Now, Norman Mineta, the transportation secretary, reported to the commission investigating 9/11 that Cheney was monitoring and guiding that missile that hit the Pentagon and made that 20-foot hole. And Cheney was intimately involved with quarterbacking the 9/11 events, and there's been no real exposure of the truth of how the shadow government did 9/11 in order to make a pretext for the invasion of the oil countries. Now, it's very important today, as the Obama White House inherits this war crimes escalation of the Afghan war, the guy in the cave had nothing to do, or maybe he was a patsy for 9/11, but the real crimes of who perpetrated 9/11 have yet to be exposed. I refer everybody to David Ray Griffin, who's done exhaustive work on 9/11, and we must stop this increase in war crimes against Afghanistan. Your comments, sir.
Well, that's very hard for me to comment on, because I guess I'm just not convinced by anything I've seen that Dick Cheney was actually the Osama bin Laden puppeteer. So, not much else I can say. I'm not convinced of that premise, and so to go anywhere with the rest of the question is kind of hard to do.
Well, let me come at that from a different angle, putting aside the whole conspiracy theory aspect of that. Have we seen the end of the aftershocks of 9/11?
Well, as long as I've got former students of mine rotating in and out of Afghanistan, I still feel the aftershocks.
Well, I guess I don't mean so much the political ramifications. Obviously, we're still embroiled in Iraq and Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. But what about in terms of fact-finding commissions, public health, things like that?
Oh, I think we're long since no longer even thinking in those kinds of terms. We're planning for other sorts of things and trying to learn some of those lessons. But I don't think that 9/11 has a big impact on the way we're planning for various future activities. There are even a lot of people who want to dismantle the Department of Homeland Security and return agencies to their natural homes that were thrown together there and do a number. There are people who just want to kind of go back to pre-9/11 structures and make some sense out of them, starting with FEMA.
You know, what's your sense on where Obama stands on that?
Well, I don't think that's the kind of question he spent a whole lot of time thinking about at this point. But he would be open, he appears, let's say, to be open to just about any kind of argument at first. You know, he'll listen and he'll decide if he thinks that's someplace where he wants to go. Now, there'll be somebody, you know, in charge of Homeland Security, Janet Napolitano, and usually you don't take charge of something for the purpose of dismantling it, but it could be that she has that agenda in the mm-hmm. back of her mind. Or maybe just to streamline it in some significant way. So it's just, you know, because it has so many disparate responsibilities that nobody can seem to figure out how to make it much of a coherent enterprise.
Another phone call now. We have Sharon on the line from Duluth. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, I wanted to go back just a bit. I've heard discussions both on this public radio and other public radios and different programs of that sort, that if we don't go ahead and look into what's been legal and illegal on the parts of the president and vice president, we just leave the door open for future presidents and vice presidents to feel comfortable with it. And the point that brought it home to me was the fact that nothing was pursued with the Reagan administration about the illegal acts in the Iran-Contra affair. And so to me, I certainly, what the guest just said makes a lot of sense. But on another level, I feel that something should be done to follow through on that, to give a message to future elected people that we will hold them to the law. And I don't know how that can be done, maybe on a lower level, but getting some results. And I think a lot of the public would like to see that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much of the public would like to see it, but it's still... It's a decent idea if a vehicle can be found other than a criminal prosecution of one or the other of those two men. So if we sort of take that off the table, what's to prevent the Congress of the United States through a Senate Select Committee to really go at it? What's to prevent another commission, not a 9/11 commission, we're not talking about that particularly, but let's say about the operations of Guantanamo Bay, what about... extraordinary rendition, throwing all those things together, it might be that a Senate investigation, a House investigation, a special commission appointed by the Senate and the House together, that we might be able to find a vehicle for condemning the actions without trying to put anybody in jail over them or say that, you know, you will be brought to the dock of justice, but to make it clear that as a society we just don't think this is the way it should be done.
It seems to me we're not very successful at doing that. I don't know whether the cases have never been strong enough. I mean, the closest I can think of are Nixon and President Clinton. What is the roadblock there? What is so difficult? Maybe you could lay out to us about either prosecuting, censuring people in power, like the president?
Well, to prosecute, you have to have a particular statute that someone has violated, and it's hard to say exactly what statutes the president of the United States has violated in this case, or even the vice president of the United States has violated. So have they broken the law? Have they bent the Constitution out of shape? Yes. Almost any constitutional lawyer will tell you that these guys stretched it to a point that it almost snapped, but that's not a crime exactly. It's a political crime. It's a tragedy. It's something you should be unelected for and punished in that sort of way, but I don't know that it's a criminal thing, and it usually works out exactly that way, that there's nothing that's clear-cut and criminal where you could go after somebody like that and convince a jury and that it would be worth the political disruption to do it. But an investigation, now, you know, we did investigate Iran-Contra, at least to a fairly substantial degree, and we did, in fact, have a serious shot at putting, what's his name, Ollie North, in jail, except the prosecutors used some testimony that he had been given immunity for, and they used it in court and blew the prosecution. But Ollie North would have spent some time in jail. Now, that's not President Reagan, but it is one of the people who was deeply involved, and Admiral Poindexter had some serious problems, too. So it's not that we don't ever go after anybody, and then, you know, the number, I can't even count the numbers from Watergate that ended up doing some prison time. They just didn't happen to include Richard Nixon. And even Spiro Agnew, when we, you know, he was just simply forced out, but he held that card. Go ahead, you're going to have to impeach me, and then you're going to have to do the, and for political reasons, everybody said, okay, look, will you agree to just step down quietly and go home? And he said, sure. So, you know, a lot of times it's the political disruption and the acrimony that gets created if you do something like that that kind of blocks prosecutors off.
You have to wonder how much it matters in the long run, too. I'm thinking about Oliver North, who's something of a celebrity in certain circles now.
Yeah,
Monica
right.
Lewinsky, sort of unscathed. Richard Nixon has a feature film about him right now. So he's sort of an interesting public figure.
Right.
I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think, you know, the Frost-Nixon thing, I was talking to a colleague the other day, that's so long ago that I'm not sure if I actually watched it or I just think I watched it, but I'm pretty sure I did. But, you know, one of the lines that's being hyped is that David Frost wanted to give Richard Nixon the trial that the American people were cheated out of. And in a sense, that interview, and because that's the vehicle in which Nixon said, if the president does it, it's not illegal. And at that exact moment, everybody just said, so that's what we had in the White House for 6 years, that attitude. And that kind of sealed his place in history, because he did have some really significant things he did, but no one will ever give him any higher rating than very mediocre for precisely that reason. So, you know, the stakes can be really high. There's no question about that. It's just interesting to see what we are able to do and what we aren't able to do. And, you know, we got pretty close to the vice president when Scooter Libby was put on trial and convicted, but then he was pardoned before anything happened.
Right. Yeah, kind of not going the full route there.
No, there was never any punishment allowed. I mean, he's disbarred and he can't practice law and all that, but I don't know that bothers him very much.
Well, let's take a quick break right now, and then we'll be back talking more with Dennis Riley, professor at UW-Stevens Point. He teaches political science there. And we'd love to hear from you this morning. Have you been keeping an eye on politics this holiday season, and what's on your mind? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send us email at talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert. In for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Still to come today on Wisconsin Public Radio, at 12:30, Jim Fleming begins reading from Christmas books by Charles Dickens, including The Cricket on the Hearth and The Chimes, a goblin story of some bells that rang an old year out and a new year in. That's coming up at 12:30 on Chapter a Day. I'm Veronica Rickert, glad to be with you this morning. I'm in for Kathleen Dunn this week, as it's All Things Political Hour with Dennis Riley, a professor of political science at the UW-Stevens Point. The number to call this morning to join in the conversation is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or shoot us an email at talk@wpr.org. And we'll take a phone call now. We have Edward on the line from Green Bay. Hi, Edward.
Hello.
Morning. Go ahead.
I was wondering, I know Nixon definitely has his detractors historically, but he also did, you know, he accomplished a lot. He opened up China and Russia, and he, you know, created the EPA. And I was just wondering if your guests thought that Bush would be kind of vindicated in the way that Nixon was in certain ways, or if he'd be vilified, you know, for a long time in the history books.
Dennis Riley?
Yeah, well, you know, it's always a little bit dangerous to speculate, but my best guess is that George Bush will have nothing that he will be able to point to or anyone else will point to that would be along the lines of opening up trade with China, beginning a relationship with China. The Environmental Protection Agency, Bush will be known more or less for attempting to undermine its scientific integrity more than anything else. So Nixon has some things. But Nixon will forever have the Christmas bombing of Vietnam around his neck. He'll forever have Watergate. So he has things that his people pointed to, which most folks, I think were overwhelmed by some others. I'm not sure what Bush would point to that would be on a par with China or with the Environmental Protection Agency or even with President Nixon's contributions to affirmative action.
Well, as you're talking about with Nixon opening up trade with China, what do you think George W. Bush himself would point to and say, okay, a lot of my tenure didn't go very well, at least as I'd planned it, but I'm proud of this. What do you think he looks back and is proud of?
Oh, I would imagine that he's proud of the very first thing he accomplished, which was cutting income taxes in the upper brackets. I think he believes that he kept, that his economy, he still believes, I think, that the economy that functioned from 2001 until beginning of 2008 was solid and it was growing, and his tax cuts were the primary reason that happened. I think he probably would point to that. I don't believe he would point to the Iraq War as a failure. I think he would point to the Iraq War as something that had to be done. I mean, the most he's said so far that doesn't seem to point in that direction was, I wish the intelligence had been different. Well, okay, but, you know, you wish the intelligence had been different. You wish it had been what you thought it was, or that they'd told you, you know, something. I mean, I don't know what that means even. So he's not going to point to Iraq and say that was a failure. He won't point to the, quote, war on terror or homeland security and say, you know, those... He'll point to those as successes. So I think that's where he would go and say, this is what I did, and this is what was good about what I did.
I know that President Clinton has talked about Rwanda as being one of the deepest regrets of his time in office. Do you think that this administration will have a similar feel about Darfur?
No, I don't. I just don't see this administration... That wouldn't be the case for Colin Powell. He has his regrets, and he knows what they are. He might tell you directly what they are, and he might not, but he knows what they are, and he thinks most people can guess them. And our policies in Africa and the problems that came out of that, I think he finds that, has deep regret about that. Condoleezza Rice may, too. She will be less prone to say so because she's so loyal to President Bush, but... I think she sees some things in a very frustrating sort of light. And I can't imagine that they won't leave office a little saddened by their inability to accomplish what they thought they could accomplish in the Middle East. That the Israeli-Palestinian situation, that Lebanon, that these things really don't appear to have gone in any positive direction on their watch. And I think that's going to be something that they probably will look back on with some regret.
Another call now from Mike in Appleton. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to ask your guest, kind of looking forward, the situation with Iran and its acquiring a nuclear weapon. You know, Obama has said, if I recall correctly, that that's something that we would not allow. Do do you think that, in fact, that is going to be the case? And if Iran does get a nuclear weapon, what does that mean?
Yeah, would I like to know that. But basically, I'm not sure what the president-elect means when he says we can't allow it. I know it means that's the language that we use when we say, boy, if you do that, something really terrible is going to happen. But I don't know what that really terrible thing is. I don't think an Obama administration is going to decide on using what few troops we have unoccupied at the moment to invade. I don't think they're going to bomb anybody. So it seems pretty unlikely that we have a mechanism. I think what he's going to try to do is to negotiate as much as possible, using as much of the rest of the world as leverage as possible, to try to convince them that it's not really in their self-interest to have such a weapon. I don't know if he's going to be able to do that.
Well, thank you for that call, Mike. And we take one now from Bill in Upper Michigan. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to ask your guest if he watched Dick Cheney on Fox News this weekend.
No.
Well, then how can you comment on it? How can either of you comment on it?
He was on ABC News. I watched that.
You watched him on what?
ABC News, interviewed by Jonathan Carl.
And what did he say? Do you agree with him that Article 1 of the Constitution has nothing to do whatsoever with the executive branch?
Article 1 creates the legislative branch, and it
right, and that's what
and it puts
didn't,
the vice president
they,
in charge of the
talking,
Senate.
Weren't they talking about Joe Biden? And what Joe Biden said during the debates, you know, quoting Article 1 and the powers of the presidency and that type of thing, that Dick Cheney was a very dangerous vice president because he broke all of the things in Article 1 of the Constitution. And don't you think that that's kind of stupid?
Well, I think it's incorrect.
Well, you know. how can you comment on Dick Cheney being defensive, or I can't remember the word that you folks used,
He's defiant.
He's defiant. Yeah. What is defiant about saying to someone, you know, Joe Biden said this about you, and then saying, well, Joe Biden's an idiot. You know, what is defiant about that?
Well, I guess, I mean, if I can jump in, Bill, I guess what I was trying to say was that Bush has been using a very affable, conciliatory tone on his way out, and Dick Cheney, well, he's defending himself, you know, justly as you think. He's not striking the same tone.
Well, let me tell you what. There's 25 or 30% of us out here that think the Bush presidency was excellent. It was an excellent bookend I'm trying to think of the president before him. I just lost my train of thought.
Before Bush?
Yeah.
Bill Clinton?
Bill Clinton. He cleaned up a lot of stuff from Bill Clinton's presidency. I mean if Saddam Hussein would not have been in power at the beginning of the Bush presidency, what would we have gone into Iraq for? Nothing. That's what. I mean, if Bill Clinton would have taken care of business on his watch, there wouldn't have been all these messes. The other thing that you folks are skinning over is that Bush had to deal with the dot-com balloon bursting, and he's had to deal with this stupid real estate balloon bursting, neither of which have a thing to do with his regulatory, basic Republican stances on regulatory issues or anything like that. I mean, for the crying out loud, there's 30% of us that are absolutely happy with his presidency, you know, and you know, you guys act like everyone's unhappy with him. We're not. I'm glad he went into Iraq. I'm really glad that Saddam Hussein is not in power anymore. I mean, for crying out loud, you act like your point of view is the only point of view that there is.
Dennis Reilly, what do you think? Does Bill represent a large, well, he's saying 25 to 30% of people, but a large portion of people who think that this was not a failed presidency, as it's frequently been called?
I'm sure that there is such a set of people, and they're entitled to view that as a successful presidency. But when you, I mean, the very fact that you say 30% of us think that this is a successful presidency that's not a very big chunk out of 100. It's really fairly small. And consequently, there's a lot of folks on the opposite side. Now, it doesn't make us right that we're on the opposite side. It just means that there's more of us, and in a democracy, that counts for something. So we say what we say. Bill says what he says. And is history going to make the judgment? I don't know. History is a bunch of people called historians. And so they'll write a bunch of stuff about it, and we'll see. And I may live long enough to sort all that out, and I may not. But I take the positions I take based on the evidence as I see it and based on my value structure. And Bill does the same. He's an informed guy who has a different set of values. There's nothing wrong with that in a democracy.
Well, Bill did bring up the economy and the busting of bubbles. And one thing that VP-elect Joe Biden has been talking about is that it seems as though they've been briefed that the economy is in, quote, much worse shape than we thought it was in. And he even went on to say that the goal of the stimulus package will be to prevent the economy from, quote, absolutely tanking, unquote. Those are pretty strong words. So.
Yes, they are. And I think he really, I'm sure he believes it. He also is you know, out there in the political cheerleading role of the vice president. They've got a package. It keeps growing. They've got new pieces they want to put in it. So he's going to go out and say, well, you know, it looks like it's worse even than we thought it was. In response to the question, does it have to be bigger? Yep, it's worse than we thought it was, so that they get some breathing room, some space to create a really massive package, which I guess, you know, when you start talking another $700 or $800 billion, that is a lot of money, and it will be phased in and all the rest of that, but that's an awful lot of money. Money we don't have, so we'll have to find it in other ways.
Well, I know that President-elect Barack Obama has said he's increasing his goal from 2.5 million to 3 million jobs over the next 2 years. Those are huge numbers that at this point almost seem theoretical. Is this just sort of like you were sort of suggesting there, just sort of drumming up support, maybe using a little bit of fear and psychology along the way?
Well, maybe a little bit. I mean, I think that they really do believe that it's that big a problem, and that they really do believe that direct government spending is a critical ingredient in dealing with that problem. And again, what they're talking about is phasing things in. That is some immediate employment things, some projects that have been put on hold all around the country by the various state governments, road projects, bridge projects, that kind of infrastructure. There's a bunch of those that could be, you know, people could be employed within the next 90 to 120 days. And that's certainly the first thing they want to do. But they're also talking about a lot of jobs that will be aimed essentially at changing the energy structure of the United States, greening things up a bit. But, I mean, changing it in ways that insulation and all that for homes and businesses, but also trying to get, as Biden said yesterday morning, trying to get the technology for bringing wind and solar power into the electricity grid so that it doesn't become kind of a funky thing that you do for your house or maybe your house and your neighbor's house, but that it becomes part of the electric transmission business. And that I don't know, but that's something they're talking about. Well, that will employ presumably quite a number of people. And so the idea is, I think, a phased, you know, instant and then a little bit longer and a little bit longer and longer term stuff that will have a lasting impact on our ability to generate economic activity rather than just get people employed right away.
Well, I know also that Barack Obama has been talking with, for instance, Christina Romer, who is the incoming chairwoman of the Council of Economic Advisors, and she's an expert on the Great Depression. And she says that the economy that she's seeing right now has eclipsed anything that she's seen in the last 50 years. I mean, do you think that's part of what the Obama administration is doing is sort of setting us up for the fact that improvement will come slowly?
Well, they have to, because it will come slowly. Some improvement can probably come, as I said, in the next 90 to 120 days. Those are, though, you know, what does that mean? We can do a lot of neat stuff for our roads and bridges and so on and so forth. Now, as some people have pointed out, that employs an awful lot more men than it does women. And so there's a questions of the impact differentially in the society, and is that good or bad? But I think they are preparing us for probably most of the first term. That's kind of presumptuous, isn't it? Most of the term to which he's been elected might be devoted to just digging out of the hole that we are in now.
Or maybe even that the hole isn't diggable.
Yeah, maybe.
I'm lost in my sentence there, but that it's not going to be something that might even be achievable through outside forces for a long time.
Well, that's a possibility. I mean, I think he believes that this can come back up, that it's possible with some short-term investment and some longer-term investment and a regeneration of confidence. I think that he feels it's possible that we'll be able to dig out. There is an awful lot of money somewhere. Can we tap into it in productive ways and get people back to work? And even though it probably is the ugliest I've seen in the 40 years I've been teaching courses about government finance and so on, it's probably the worst. The late 70s stagflation was pretty ugly, and maybe it doesn't quite compare to that. But I'll defer to anybody that could chair the Council of Economic Advisors on that. I'll just say, be quiet for a minute. But, you know, it seems like we are a little more optimistic politically now than we were at the tail end of the 70s. We aren't so close to Watergate. I mean, yeah, we have the things that people are upset about with President Bush, but they're not the same magnitude as Watergate following Vietnam, two presidencies that many people feel were failed, you know, Johnson's and Nixon's. Coming after each other. And so, I mean, I think we maybe have more political optimism heading into now, although Ronald Reagan certainly generated a lot of that when he came into office. But, you know, we may be more upbeat about what might be able to happen, and we may be able to unleash this thing called confidence a little quicker. And if we are, then maybe things will begin to look up, and once they start looking up, they tend to look up. What we need to make sure we don't do is the last two times we've sort of, you know, dug out of holes, we dug out with bubbles, and the bubbles popped on us.
Okay, let's take another phone call. Tom with us from Green Bay. Hi, Tom.
Hi. One of the questions I got, I've read about is the cost of tuition for our colleges has gone from one-fourth of the pie to one-half of the pie for tuition paying for the total college education. My question is how is Obama going to do something? Is he going to be able to do something about that? And the other thing is I would like to see the universities federalized so that there isn't any interstate tuition cost.
Wow. Now, that's interesting. I really don't see that on the horizon. I think the states are so ferociously proud of their institutions of higher learning, whether they're proud of their football teams or their research, you never know, but I don't see that becoming a federalized business anytime soon. I think what Obama might really be able to do, though, is to attempt to increase the amount of money available to those universities in two senses, available to students who attend those universities and available to the universities themselves as part of research into a wide range of things, that some of that money will funnel into universities, and then they can use it to do the things that they think they need to do. I mean, it won't come with no strings, but will come with at least not too terribly many. But, yeah, it is. We are reaching the point where tuition is such a huge part of paying for the university, and the state appropriations, while they continue to increase, they don't increase as a percentage of what we need, and so we keep hitting the students for more and more. And we keep hitting them for more and more, essentially by having them borrow more and more. And I have conversations with some of my students about the amount of debt they carry out. And, you know, I was on my third house before I owed anybody that much money. And they're walking away with a bachelor's degree, and they want to go to law school, or they want to go to graduate school, or maybe they want to work a couple of years and then do it. And they owe, you know, $30,000-$40,000 at age 22. It's mind-boggling to me, and it's scary because it could ultimately mean fewer and fewer of them are going to be able to do it at a time when we need more and more. So I think Tom is on to something. We have to address that problem. I think it will be addressed at the state level, but I think the feds can provide some of the money that will allow us to address it.
Well, thank you for that call, Tom. And we'll take another break right now and come back, talk more during All Things Political with Dennis Riley, who's a professor of political science at the UW Stevens Point. And the phone number for you to join in this morning is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can also send us email at talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickard, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up today on Wisconsin Public Radio, Larry Mueller and his guests take a look at the oddball world of ice fishing. Lane Kennedy and Greg Brining are the authors of A Hard Water World, Ice Fishing and Why We Do It. That's Larry Mueller coming up at 11 o'clock today. I'm Veronica Rickert with you this morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Monday morning, so it's All Things Political as we talk with Dennis Riley, a professor of political science at the UW Stevens Point. And we'll take a call right now from Sean with us from Madison. Hi, Sean.
Hey, Veronica. Terrific show, as always.
Thank
Great
you.
Guest. Nothing to say about the president, because that's been expounded upon, I believe, ad nauseum. But the thing I noticed that was really quite curious about Bill the caller was when he fell offline for about 10 or 15 seconds there, it seemed like a year, it was almost like the internet connection from conservative echo chamber radio had come unplugged temporarily, because he was like so on message at beginning, and then he couldn't remember Bill Clinton's name, which is also a classic stalling strategy for them. But there's a great article on the front page of the Times this morning about New Dawn for conservative radio. And I find it very interesting that now that they have probably a very potentially excellent liberal president on tap for what I'm hoping is 8 years, that they're all jazzed up, because it's so much easier to be on offense against something that's working than it is to be on defense for something that isn't. So I'll take my comments off the air, but thanks for doing great radio every day.
All
take
right.
care.
Thanks a lot, John. Dennis Riley?
Yeah, there's not much you can say in response to that.
Did you see the article Sean's talking about?
I haven't yet. I haven't looked at the Times yet this morning. But certainly I would believe that, and he's dead on as to the reasons. I mean, I'm sure that secretly Hannity and Combs and all kinds of other people are really happy that they don't have to defend a John McCain presidency, which I think they thought might go in any direction that was possible. Now they can just sharpen the knives and wait for the first thing. I mean, they're after him about Blagojevich and any contacts with Blagojevich, and you know, they're just practicing up. So Sean's right. They're pumped and they're ready to just go after this new president from the first day.
What about, this isn't radio, but where does this put shows like Rachel Maddow is radio too, but Rachel Maddow and Keith Olbermann?
I don't know, but I think I'll find out. You know, I don't know if I'll get to watch them quite as regularly as I did. My two grandsons are here, and they're a little young to watch that. So I won't be doing that for the next couple of weeks. But I think they will find various and sundry things to continue to be outraged by. I don't think that they're going to find this president, though solid in ideological terms from their side of the political spectrum, not as far to the left as either of them are likely to be. And some things are going to happen that they can criticize. And there is, after all, a Congress, and the Congress does have Republicans in it, so there will still be some entertainment for them from the congressional Republicans. And, you know, state governments, I mean, they'll find things that they'll be able to play with. It can't be as easy. I mean, it was like Jon Stewart. It took Jon Stewart a while to find his sea legs with respect to Obama. How do you kind of needle a president that you really don't think needs as much needling as the previous one? But he'll find a way, just as those two will.
Well, I guess I'm curious about sort of the fact that the hallmark of the Obama campaign is that he has assembled this sort of feel-good coalition. And I guess this is still the honeymoon period, but he's sort of trying to put up this united front, people from all different areas, all different political persuasions. Are people going to feel a little constrained not to want to be sort of the bad guy who's crying foul?
For a little while.
But, not going to last.
But it won't last, no. It's in the nature of folks who do shows like The Daily Show and who do shows like Rachel Maddow and Keith Olbermann. it's in their nature to be critical, to look for those things that where there might be even a hint of hypocrisy, and that's their job, and they'll find it because it just happens to play out somehow, some way or other. So I think that everybody's going to go back to normal, but clearly a show like Olbermann or a show like Rachel Maddow can never go back to what it was when they had George Bush working for them full time. I mean, that's the way they would probably put it.
Let's take another phone call now. Here is Jim with us from Salt Lake City. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Professor Riley. Hey, I guess my comment is I think President Bush has been kind of isolated, and what few interviews I've heard him give, I think he's going to think that his presidency is finally going to be judged similar to that of President Truman, that when President Truman left, you know, the Korean War was going on, it was very unpopular, made the tough choices, and his popularity sank to 40%. But afterwards, they just liked his charm and all this folksy stuff that I think President Bush thinks he's living in that shadow. He'll have that same legacy later on. And then the final comment I want to make is, after hearing about the last Congress and this Congress, I'm kind of worried for the Democrats, because the Republicans had both branches of government, and for a party who believed in small government and reducing everything, they actually did the opposite. They had a bigger deficit, bigger government. And I think the Democrats have a short opportunity to, you know, go on their platform, and if they vie from that, I don't think we'll ever see that in our lifetime again, where the legislature and the executive branch of the same party.
Hmm.
Well,
we've had
some periods, obviously. We had periods of complete Republican control, periods of Democratic control, and split periods. So we've had all of that over the post-World War II period, or let's say the 20th century into the 21st, and I think we will see it every now and then. The Democrats have a real structural advantage in terms of holding on to the House of Representatives, given there's some complicated electoral numbers, but they do have such an advantage right now. Whether they have an advantage in hanging on to the White House or not, that'll be interesting to see. I think right now they have a president with a great deal of support, with a lot of positive numbers, and people feeling pretty good about him. And he's not going to hold the 70% approval rating he's got right now, because no president does. But he may be able to hold in the 50s for a while, and maybe even a crack 60 once in a while. So we'll just have to see how that plays out. The Congress, as long as the Senate maintains its voting rules, its filibuster rules, the Senate's going to be a very interesting institution to watch. That will be the place where the Republicans are best equipped to make their stand against the direction that Senator Obama might want to take the country.
What about critiques right now that Congress is sort of acting a little wimpy, that as though they don't have any power? Are they waiting for Barack Obama to come in to take leadership role, or what's going on with Congress right now?
Well, yes, they are, and Congress has been known to do that fairly regularly. That is, not to want to take full responsibility for dramatic action. And so to say, well, until we get, we need some presidential leadership on this. We need to see where the White House is going to go on this. And I think they are kind of waiting so that they don't have to do it through their own rather parochial institution. I mean, the Congress remains pretty much a parochial institution. People represent districts, they represent states, and they represent them fiercely. They take a national perspective when that's comfortable, but most of the time they take a more local perspective, and it's hard for anybody to gather those folks up and say, okay, this is the direction we're going in. But a president can provide a platform for the leadership of the House and Senate to say, hey, this is where it's our president, and this is where we want to go. And then other people, maybe we can get some other people on board if his ideas are broad enough and reach out to the other side. So they are waiting in some sense for everything to sort of sort out. The leaders of the House and Senate also are waiting for the new House and the new Senate. They like the numbers better.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. Wayne from Grafton, we're almost out of time, but if you could ask your question really quickly, I'd appreciate it.
Yes. I'd like to know, why is Congress balking and demanding reforms for the auto industry, you know, sacrifices that they totally revamp, and union workers give up salaries that they have, but the same demands weren't made for the Wall Street bailout, and they got a whole lot more. I mean, it just seriously irked me to hear that they still got big bonuses. The executives, it seems like they had no consequences. They were just giving checks. And here you have working people or unions that represent working people, industries that represent working people, and they're told you have to reform or else you're not going to get any more money.
Okay, let's leave it there. And Dennis Riley, your answer in about 20 seconds.
Yeah, because there's a lot of Southern senators that don't much like unions. And they do like foreign automakers who make cars in their states. So they just stood up for two things, and they made it work because of the voting rules.
Well, thank you so much for being with us this morning. It's been a pleasure to talk with
you. It was a lot of fun.
All right. Dennis Riley was with us this morning, professor of political science at the UW Stevens Point. This morning was All Things Political. Tomorrow morning, we'll be talking with the author of the article, Why Wall Street Always Blows It, and taking a look at the latest findings about vitamins as well. Seems lots of the studies coming out have not been so hopeful about the use of vitamins. I'm Veronica Riggert. Thanks for listening this morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.